This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. High-minded and fine, thoroughly absorbing and deeply moving. These are among the descriptions of Robert Halenga's first novels, The 16 Pleasures and The Fall of a Sparrow. His third novel, Blues Lessons, is also drawing critical praise. The Los Angeles Times says Blues Lessons is an important novel, a historical document of sorts, reminding us of who we were before we got here today. Robert Halenga is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Let me tell you something about the story told in Blues Lessons. Blues Lessons begins in 1954 in Appleton, Michigan, in the orchards of the Dyksterhuis family. Martin Dyksterhuis is about to enter his junior year in high school. Marty's also about to discover the blues and fall in love. Marty's girlfriend, Karina, is the daughter of the orchard's foreman and his wife, Cap'n Flo Williams. Marty and Corey have grown up together, playing imaginary games in the woods, going to the same schools. The families are close, but color separates them. The Williamses are black, the Dyksterhuises are white. Marty and Corey must hide their feelings for one another. Robert Halenga is a professor of English at Knox College in Galesburg. Like Marty, he knows the blues. The music we opened with this afternoon, that was Robert Halenga, so stay tuned. We'll talk with him this afternoon about the blues and blues lessons and play some of the music that inspired the novel. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. You can join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Robert Halenga, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to speak with you. Do you remember when you first heard the blues?
I don't remember very clearly, but I'm pretty sure it was in Chicago at the Old Town School of Folk Music. That's when I became seriously interested in any case.
Hmm. Do you remember what you first started to play?
Well, we lived in Chicago for a year, mm-hmm. and we didn't have a piano. I always played the piano. So I bought a classical guitar. I thought classical would be more my style than blues, but I took classical lessons, and that didn't take. And then I started taking some lessons at Old Town, and something about that music that really spoke to me and continues to speak to me.
Yeah.
That was 1975.
Mm. Well, tell us how Marty Dyksterhuis discovers the blues in Blues Lessons.
Well, he and the men who pick peaches and apples for his father sometimes make music in the evenings. And the picking camp is forbidden territory for both Martin and Corinna. But they sometimes go out there, and one night they go out there, and there's a new man who's playing the blues in a way that Martin hasn't heard before. He's playing a slide guitar, and I believe the song he's playing is Moon Going Down, and Martin falls in love with Corinna right at the same time that he hears this song, which I always think of as a very piercing song.
Yeah. It's a very sensual moment. Marty says, the sounds came into me. I breathed them, inhaled them, along with the odors of the outhouse and the smoke from the fire, through my mouth as well as my ears, through my eyes. Chesterfield was singing a song about love, but not the kind of love I knew about from movies and from the radio. This was more like someone driving nails into a piece of oak. A lot of power in that music.
Well, I think that one of the things that appeals to me about the blues is that it's so unsentimental. It seems to me there's genuine feeling and genuine love, but it dispenses with the sentimentality that usually surrounds that in popular songs.
Mm-hmm. Later in the story, Marty will talk about the blues as a music of longing, and later still he speaks of the blues as giving us the tears of things and the joys of things.
Well, I think that, I mean, the blues does an awful lot of things, but I think the thing that sticks with me are the great images of train stations, and standing in the station, my suitcase in my hand, or standing in the station and the train's pulling out, with my babies on board. And those moments of parting seem to me, they're extremely important in my experience. I think they are in everyone's experience. That saying goodbye to people you love just seems to me to be a central experience that brings things into focus.
Hmm. Marty is a character who is very rooted to his home in Appleton, but he's also a wandering soul in a way too, isn't he?
Well, his ambition in a way is to stay there, but when he hears that blues music, he feels that he's discovered his vocation, and that vocation is going to be at odds with the desire to stay home. And I think you see that split in the blues a lot. On the one hand, you have a lot of people trying to get back home, and they're longing for their home, but they're, for various reasons, pulled away from it.
Yeah. Early in the story, he's just learning how to play the guitar, and he's singing and playing in his bedroom. He's still in high school, and he speaks of being caught up in these two places, in looking back over his life. He talks about being caught up in two different stories. Do you know the scene I'm speaking
yes.
of? Would you read it for us?
Okay, what?
It begins on page 32.
Okay, I've got it right here. Where it begins, there were no guitar teachers
yeah,
in Appleton.
Right.
And how far would you like me to go?
I think through the end of the lyric that
okay.
on 34.
There were no guitar teachers in Appleton, Michigan, and the only instruction book I could find in the music store in Niles was in Spanish, Emilio Pujol's Escuela Razonata de la Guitarra. I figured out that P equals pulgar equals thumb, and that I equals indice equals index finger, and so on. And I figured out the notes, which are more complicated than on the piano. On the piano, the notes are all lined up in a row, but on the guitar, the same notes show up in three or sometimes four different places. School started. Mr. Haptenstall, my piano teacher, brought the two-piano version of Rhapsody in Blue to my first lesson, and my mother threw herself into the second piano part. I continued to take lessons without kicking up too much of a fuss, but I never learned the solo part of Rhapsody in Blue, nor did I learn any of the other piano music that my mother ordered from Fisher's in an attempt to deflect my interest from my new vocation. Art Tatum, Ubi Blake, Lionel Hampton, Duke Ellington. I like this music well enough, and sight-read my way through arrangements of Take the A Train, and I'm in the Mood for Love. But my heart never leaped up to meet the more complex jazz chords. My feet didn't dance. My soul wasn't stirred by the love lyrics, which seemed bland to me compared to Chesterfield's songs, which I continued to listen to over and over on the tape recorder after the season was done. I told you you could go, and don't come back here no more. It's your last time shaking it in the bed with me.
And I'd like you to continue. I sang along with the tape because I want you to get into the part of the story here where he says, alone in my room, I pondered these mysteries.
Okay. I sang along with the tape, keeping my voice down, especially on the last line, which I found terribly exciting in all its variations. I mean twisting. I mean turning. I mean doing that monkey dog and all that slop. Though not as exciting as the mystery of the opening, why did the singer tell her she could go? Why didn't he want her to come back here no more? Alone in my room, I pondered these mysteries. At the same time, I couldn't separate them from my feelings for Corey, and in fact, I've never been able to separate them. I seemed to be caught up in two different stories, but sometimes I thought that one was a translation of the other, and sometimes I thought that they were both translations of still another story, it was too old for anyone to remember. Looking back, I can see that these two stories run through my life like the two rails of a railroad track. And when I stand between them and look down the track, I can see them meet at the horizon, and I experience a kind of longing that almost breaks my heart, though now I've learned to expect it from time to time, and in fact, to regard it as the central experience in my life, something I couldn't live without. At the same time, however, I thought that if only I could learn this song or that song, I'd be satisfied. And I thought the same thing about Corey, that if only I could hold her in my arms and kiss her, I'd be, well, satisfied. But it didn't work out that way. And when I hear that old song, Corinna, Corinna, I'm filled with a longing for Corey. And when I think of Corey, I'm filled with a longing for that old song, even though I can play it in three different versions, even though I've held Corey in my arms and kissed her. Corinna, Corinna, where you been so long? Corinna, Corinna, where you been so long? Ain't had no lovin' since you been gone.
Maybe you would talk with us about the power of stories in our lives and your vocation in telling them.
Excuse me. Yes, that's a subject, in fact, I keep coming back to, and I think it's a subject I often hear on Garrison Keillor and News from Lake Wobegon, that we are our stories. And I used to think that someday I'd sit down with, I don't know, the Bible and a history of philosophy and whatnot, and just figure things out. But now I know that that's never going to happen. And I think that at the core of every great religion, what you find are not doctrines or creeds, but stories. And I think that stories take us as close as we can get to the heart of things. When you come up against a mystery, you can only go so far. And then at that point, you have to just, all you can do is tell a story about it. And so that's where I am right now, and that's what I feel I'm trying to do as a writer.
What you just said is a line from The Fall of a Sparrow as well, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. I have to be careful not to repeat myself, because that idea is so central to my way of thinking about things.
Yeah. So there...
You've done your homework.
there's a lot of you in your novels.
Yes. But I think that can be misleading, because I think that when you put yourself or other things, characters based on people you've known or you know, I think that generally there's a little twist in there, sometimes a major twist, that can turn it into its opposite. And I think sometimes when the resemblance seems closest, it may be farthest away. And when you don't see any resemblance at all, actually, it may be closer there.
Robert Halenga is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his new novel, Blues Lessons. He's also the author of The 16 Pleasures and The Fall of a Sparrow. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls. Questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. How do your characters begin to take shape in your imagination?
That's a good question, and I'm never quite sure of it. Obviously, one thing that I keep coming back to is the father-daughter relationship. And I have three daughters, and in the first two novels, there's a father and three daughters. And I thought in this novel, I just didn't want to do that again, just as I didn't want to have anyone go to Italy again. But it turned out I couldn't get away from that. And then when I sent a first version, a very early version, to my agent, he said, "What's all this stuff about the blues player? You know, this is a novel about the daughter." And I had just thrown in the daughter. I think I couldn't get on along without a daughter. I didn't know where the story was going. And so then the daughter eventually became sort of the main storyline and push the blues to one side. So that's probably the starting place for my central situations, is in that relationship. And now I've come back to that again in the novel I'm working on. And I hate to think that I only have one story, but I think that's the source of inspiration. And then other characters grow out of, I mean, I think that's what lies at the center. And then you sort of pick up other characters as you go along.
Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of different ways. I wouldn't say there's just one way, but...
It seems to me the first part of Blues Lessons is Marty's story, and then the second part, we really delve into Corey's story.
Yeah, and one of the most difficult things I had in Blues Lessons was moving through that length of time. I know novelists do it all the time, but I had never done it. I'd always stuck to a reasonably limited or a fairly limited time period. And I had to give some time for the daughter to grow up. And so I really struggled with that for a long time. I think I got it worked out, but I think you're right. There is a shift away from Martin's story and his vocation to, I would say not Corinna, but, well, Corinna and the daughter, Cozy.
Hmm. So there's a shift and then a coming back together, coming almost full circle.
Yes, when he goes back home again. I mean, the big rift has been created actually by his mother, who has sort of expelled the Williams family from the Garden of Eden, in which at least Martin thinks they're living in.
Yeah.
And this is the rift that has to be healed and is healed rather tentatively at the end.
Mm. Marty sees Appleton as paradise, at least as a young man, doesn't he? He says,
yes.
This is where the Creator had held the earth when he shaped the world.
Right, the shape of Michigan.
Yeah, you could see his palm print on the map, shaped like Michigan's lower peninsula. Talk with us about Marty's feelings for Appleton and the family orchard.
Well, those grew out of my own experience in a small town, and I know my cousin, I know lots of people who had a very different experience, who couldn't wait to get out of there, who saw it as provincial and a prison, but my experience was very positive, and I lived in a place like Dijksterhuis Corners. It was called Hellinger's Corners. I mean, that wasn't the official name, but I had both grandparents, or both grandmothers, aunts and uncles and cousins lining the street, and I thought it was just wonderful. And there were a lot of houses where you could go in where you didn't have to knock on the door, and there were lots of kids. I had 13 female cousins. And I wasn't aware of certain tensions that the grown-ups felt. But anyway, so for me it was a very positive experience, and I couldn't understand why anybody would ever want to move away.
Mm. But Corey doesn't see Appleton as paradise, and Marty's mother also feels very stifled in Appleton.
Yes, and it takes Martin a long time. I mean, this is one of the main things he has to learn in the novel, both about his mother and about Corinna. And they're up on the water tower, and she writes this obscenity on the water tower. He just can't believe it, and he covers it over, so it reads, "Evoke this town." But that's his first sense that this small town might look different to a young black girl, even though there's been no overt racial incident.
Mm. The CD that came to me tucked inside a copy of the book contains a Lead Belly tune. I believe it's a Lead Belly tune. It's a bourgeois town.
Yeah, bourgeois blues.
Yeah, and I think for Corey, that's how she sees Appleton. It would have been a lot more words and, you know, a lot more letters to paint on the water tower, but she could have painted that up there on the water tower.
In a way, things aren't. I struggle with a lot of different versions of that, but what seems to motivate her more, at least in my mind, than it's not so much a racial issue as the small town issue, and she's very ambitious, and she moves on to Madison, and then she's not satisfied with Madison; she wants to move on to New York. So that's her Whereas Martin has this impulse to stay in the small town.
Hmm. We should tell the listeners, I think, a little bit more about the plot at this point. These two young people are seniors in high school, and it's homecoming, and they climb the ladder up the water tower, and she paints this expletive about the town on the water tower. He tries to bandage it up, and then they fall into one another's arms. And as a result of making love, there's a child. And Corey and her family leave town.
Yes,
they're expelled.
Parents pay them to sort of buy them out.
Yeah. You know, we would talk just a little bit about the character of Martin's mother. What would you like to say about his father? He's a really great character.
Well, the father's a much more easygoing guy. He's really more kind of like one of my uncles, who seemed to be very much at home with the racial situation. The mother is a declared liberal, and she winds up violating her principles, whereas Marty's father just hangs out with Corinna's father. They are good friends. They do a lot of things together. And he feels, I think, some of that same uneasiness. His wife, Marty's mother, has been to the University of Chicago. It's clear she feels, you said earlier, strangled in this small town, and he's hopeless to do anything about it because this has been his whole life. And so there's a kind of sadness about that he expresses at only one point, really, where he tells Martin he couldn't give Martin's mother the kind of life she wanted.
Mm.
But he's pretty much of a nice guy.
A lot of heartbreak throughout the story.
No, I always try to go to... I think I'm drawn to that heartbreak. You got to be careful not to overdo it.
Right, right. You know, in describing the story, it's very difficult for somebody like me because it's like, well, how do you describe it and give it the kind of life that the author has given it? How do I be fair? You know, how can I be fair to Robert Halenga in trying to describe the story?
Well, I think you're doing just fine.
Thank you. There are also lots of elements to this story. We have music and fruit and missionaries and a Steinway and beauty parlors and the railroad and the University of Chicago and Chicago blues clubs. It's really a wonderful mix. It's very delightful. How do you come to pull all these elements together? How conscious is it? Or is it something that happens easily?
Well, in a lot of cases, I really have to fake. I mean, I have an idea of what I want. It's based on some emotional need. But then, for example, the railway post office, the father of a friend of mine when I was a kid worked for the railway post office, and the train would slow down in Three Oaks, and he would jump off. And I thought that was just so fantastic. To see that, you know. And it really made an impression on me. And I knew these people very well. But it took a lot of effort to figure out just how the railway post office system worked. And I was in touch with the father of my friend, and I asked him so many questions, and he explained so many things, and I just had a lot of trouble getting it. So I do an awful lot of research. It grows out of some genuine emotional need, and then I think if you can fill in the language, like I've never done a lot of performing as a blues player, but, you know, I read stuff about it and accounts, and I subscribe to Acoustic Guitar Magazine, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So you really enjoy doing the research for a novel.
I have found that doing research is totally different from what I expected. When I started writing, I thought that novelists just knew all this stuff. I never gave it much thought. And then I realized that I didn't know anything about any of these things, like book conservation and the 16 pleasures and all sorts of things of the railway post office. And so it took me a long time to realize that everybody else is doing this kind of research, too. I did a blurb for a book called Novel Ideas, which interviews with 20 contemporary novelists. And I was amazed. I think in every single interview, the subject of research came up, and it turns out to be central to the person's work. And it's just somehow something I never thought of. But I found that every time I do research, anything, you find all kinds of things that you just never would think of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm writing about a man who raises avocados now, just reading the California Avocado Growers Handbook. You find out about the little clippers they have to use, and you pull the stem out, it'll ruin the avocado and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time doing research.
Yeah. Well, you're a guy who loves stories, and, you know, just thinking about the research you did for the railway post office, talking to your friend's father, he must have told you great stories.
There was a man in town in Galesburg. Galesburg was a big railroad town. But most of those men are dead now. In fact, the man in Galesburg I talked to, but he had some old videos of railway post office reunions. And these were just homemade, and they'd get a guy and sit him out on the steps and say, tell us about your first run. Well, some of them clearly didn't have any training at all. They say, well, they said that when the engineer blows the whistle, you throw this stack of newspapers out the door. So I found all kinds of things like that.
Yeah.
The story about the elephant sticking its trunk out of a circus car and hitting the mailbag.
And to think that these guys, they were supposed to know every street in the city, that amazes me.
Well, a lot of them did. I know my friend's father did in Chicago and Detroit, and he knew a lot of other stuff, too.
Yeah.
But I think these videos were from way back, you know, and, or the man who said, well, they said that when the engineer blows the whistle, to throw the newspapers out the door, you know. That must have been, he was a very old man, and that was an old video, so.
I can't imagine. This was before the zip code.
Oh, yeah, way before the zip code.
So. Well, one of the things I wondered about as I read Blues Lessons is, you know, would a pippin apple tree do well in central Illinois? Could I plant one in my yard?
Well, I don't know about that.
I'll just have to do my own research on that one.
Yeah, you can look it up on the web now.
Let's talk a little bit about the guitar that Marty buys from Chesterfield, one of the workers in the orchard. It's a National Steel guitar.
They call those sort of garbage can guitars. There's a guy when I started looking for a National Steel guitar, those are made out of bronze and chrome-plated. I ran into a guy in town who had a lot of these old guitars, and gosh, they really sound funky, but they're just made out of old sheet metal. And then they painted them these awful colors, you know, brown and yellow. So they're pretty funky. And then later on, he buys a nicer guitar.
Yeah. The guitar that you're playing on the CD, is that a National Steel guitar?
Yes. Actually, it's made by the Dobro Company, but it's a metal resophonic guitar. And the whole business of the names is very complicated, and I don't really want to get into that here.
Yeah.
But basically, it is that kind of guitar.
Yeah. Now, the sound that guitar gets, is it similar to the sound of those, quote, garbage can guitars?
Yes, except it's nicer, you know. I mean, you get more sustain and I think a more piercing tone. The other is just like it's really crude, you know. Actually, I haven't heard one in quite a few years, but it sounded like a guitar. But
yeah. Speaking of sounds, I can hear the train in the background.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yes, I should have closed the windows, but
no, I like that. I think we should just
yeah, we got a lot of trains
that.
Through here.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could play one of the selections from this CD.
Okay, and
to
I wondered if you wanted to. You, I looked up a passage on Reverend Taylor, too, if you want to.
Oh, yeah. Well, we want to talk about that, too, because I think that's a wonderful scene in the novel. There's an old blues musician, Reverend Taylor, who's offering Marty some advice about playing. Well, maybe we should read that first and then play a selection from the CD where we can hear that steel guitar. I'm thinking about the scene on page 133.
I've got that here.
And Marty's played for the Reverend, and now he's waiting to hear what the Reverend has to say.
Reverend Taylor listened with his eyes closed, his lips pursed. Did that song bring back memories? Dark last night, thought I heard my baby call my name. Moon ain't gonna shine till my baby come back again. You can sure play a lot of notes, he said when I finished the song and put my guitar down on my lap. Thanks, I said, but my heart sank because I knew it wasn't a compliment. And I knew that what I really wanted was not criticism, but praise. More than praise, really. I was applying for my blues license. I wanted Reverend Taylor's stamp of approval, like a driver's license or a pilot's license. You really got the feel for the blues, he said, and I started to puff up a little. Of course, he went on, you don't need any extra special feelings to play the blues. You already got all the special feelings you need. Any person alive in this world has all the feelings it needs to play the blues. What sets a blues musician apart from other people is not special feelings. It's the ability to play the music, to pick the guitar or blow the harp. You don't need any rarefied feelings for that. What you need is talent, and a little bit of talent will take you a long ways. But you got to relax a little. It makes me tired just to look at you work so hard. You got to let the big levers move the little ones instead of the other way around. Let the power flow from your body into your fingers. To get your speed, what you got to do is practice slow, real slow, and plant your fingers before you pick a string so you're not waving your fingers around in the air like you do, hoping they're going to land in the hole between the strings when the time comes. To get a nice tone, you got to take care of your fingernails with a good fine emery board. Don't go cutting at them with one of them clippers, and then file them down with some real fine sandpaper. I know you don't believe me, but I'm telling you what I know. Folks was always asking me how I got such a nice tone out of my cheap old Stella. And when I told them I'd take care of my fingernails, they didn't want to believe me.
Is it important how you take care of your fingernails?
Yes, it is. Now, I don't know a lot of old bluesmen. The only one I really got to know is John Jackson. His fingernails were kind of like pieces of rock. I don't know. Now, I have a lot of trouble with my fingernails, but that's probably a little out of character for a blues player, but I wanted to go against the stereotype, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what does Corey think of this love affair that Martin has with the blues?
Well, Corey's not very interested in the blues.
Yeah.
And in fact, the blues really, the audience for the blues is really young white people like me, or more like Martin, like I used to be. And Corey's attitude was, and her mother's attitude, I said, what are you playing that old stuff for? This is stuff we want to forget about. So there's a kind of middle class dislike of that music, which a lot of black people felt and I think still feel.
Yeah. There's a scene in the novel where Corey and Martin meet up, say, years later. They meet in Madison, and Corey's...
Right. She can't understand.
Yeah.
She doesn't understand why he's doing this, you know. Why are you playing this old stuff, you know? This is old down-home stuff. And that theme runs throughout the novel. She says, you know, yeah, you play pretty good, but she never understands why he's doing this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's quite a powerhouse. She wants to move on. She wants to...
Right. She's very strong-willed.
Yeah. And she's... When they meet, it's 1964, and this is... He sees her, and when she appears, it's the first Afro hairstyle
that he's ever seen.
And he goes, well, it's a little scary. She says, that's the point. That's a great line. That's a great line. Well, now what should we play from this CD?
Well, I'll leave that up to you. I mean, okay. There's Corinna, Corinna.
That's nice. We got Sweet Home Chicago. Jesus, Will You Come By Here? And it's a bourgeois town. I don't know.
Well,
lots of good stuff. How about Corinna, Corinna?
Okay.
It's cut 7. I've got to let my director know. Robert Halenga, Corinna, Corinna. What can you tell us about that song? It's really old. I know that. Is it a Robert Johnson tune?
Well, there are all kinds of versions of this. And I just have to...
Because at home I have a recording of Eric Clapton.
Well, that,
doing
this
it.
One is Eric Clapton and B.B. King did a version together. And that's kind of the one that I did on that... tape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have several other versions. You know, I'm really drawing a blank. I ought to know that. My stuff, I did enough research on that, but... I remember. The first version of that comes up in a song by Blind Lemon Jefferson, and it's not called Corinna, Corinna. But one of the verses has the Corinna, Corinna line in it, and I believe that's the earliest form of that song.
Because the version I have at home with Clapton doing it, it's Alberta, Alberta.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess whoever your woman was, she had 3 syllables in her name. You fill it right in.
Well, I love the name Corinna.
It is a lovely name. Very lovely name. The characters that you create there's a lot of life in them, and they really come alive on the page. I'm wondering what it's like for you to close the book, so to speak, on them when you're finished with a novel.
Well, when you're finished, you're still not finished, because then there's all the copy editing, and it just goes on and on like that. That's not the question you're asking, I'm sure, but... Well, it's a good feeling, you know. And I usually have something else going by the time I'm finished with one. But I thought in the 3 novels, I've been really happy with the ending, so I felt kind of a sense of closure.
I would think also for a writer it would be important to have another thing going so that you wouldn't get caught.
Well, by the time you sell it and go through things with an editor and do that, you've like 6 or 8 months have gone by. So,
what happens in the copy editing stage? Is it any more than tidying up?
Well, and with the 16 Pleasures, it was different. We made some major changes, and really in the conception of the story. It didn't involve too much rewriting, but it gave, we decided, the editor, I thought, had very good suggestions, and we gave the story a much more upbeat ending. She said, you know, Margot's, the original ending was kind of melancholy, and the editor said, well, Margot's gone through all this stuff. Why is she back to square one, you know? She should be sitting on top of the world. So that was a pretty major conceptual change. As I say, it didn't involve too much rewriting. The other two novels, we haven't made, oh, there have been some decisions to eliminate a chapter or something like that, but there hasn't been any major reconceptualizing or rethinking. Hmm. And then that's with the editor, and then with the copy editor, then they're worried about street names and spellings and getting the facts straight.
Hmm. Do you have a title for the next one?
Yeah, but I don't know if I want to tell anybody. I've never gotten the title I started out with. So.
Okay. You want to tell us just, besides avocados, what else is...
Well, it's about the father in the 16 Pleasures.
Okay.
And one of the things that I did in there, without giving it much thought, was send him, he goes to Texas to raise avocados. And so this is going to be his story. It's going to be a story of that family, too. But
Interesting. Well, I'll get back to you on that Pippin apple tree. See if I can...
Pippins, you know, we didn't really... They used to have Pippins. The Pippins were all gone when I was a kid. It was my brother's favorite apple.
Hmm.
And now I think a lot of those old apples are making a comeback.
Yeah.
But we didn't, they don't travel very well, see, so you can't market them and send them off. And
yeah, well, they would only have to go from the yard into the kitchen.
Yeah.
Robert Holenga, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this
afternoon.
Thank
you very much.
Robert Holenga has been our guest in this portion of The Afternoon Magazine. His new novel is Blues Lessons. He's also the author of The 16 Pleasures and The Fall of a Sparrow. He is professor of English at Knox College in Galesburg. His new book, Blues Lessons, is published by Scribner.